This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kooser. We're taking a closer look at the status of the opioid crisis in Connecticut, which we heard much about prior to the pandemic, but has dropped somewhat from public view since. First responders, like paramedics, are among the people who, through firsthand experience, see trends in addiction. Peter Canning is one of them. He's the lead EMS coordinator at UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital, and he works full-time as a paramedic in Hartford. And he's also written a book about his experience. It's called Killing Season, A Paramedic's Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Opioid Epidemic. And Peter Canning joins us now on the phone. Mr. Canning, welcome back to The Full Story.
Hey, thanks, Sam, for having me on.
Certainly. Last time you were on the program, I think that goes back about 2 years, you told us how you began collecting data on the opioid-related calls that you worked in Hartford and how that became a statewide program called SWORD. Could you remind us what SWORD stands for again and just how that data is put together?
SWORD is a statewide opioid response reporting directive. So in Connecticut, anytime a paramedic or an EMT responds to a suspected opioid overdose after they've taken care of the patient, they call the Connecticut Poison Control Center and answer a series of questions about the call. That data is then inputted into a software base and into a mapping software. So a number of different things it enables us to do. It enables us to see how many overdoses there are, where they're taking place. We get details on some of the overdoses to spot trends. For instance, we've noticed lately what happens a lot is people might buy a Percocet pill on the street, but it turns out not to be Percocet at all, but to be a counterfeit pill with fentanyl in it, so that they're taking what they think is a safer pill and are overdosing. We've had similar things where people have thought that they were just using cocaine, but then they required naloxone, which only works on opioid overdoses. So we've been able to find there's a lot of contamination out there. So we're able to warn cocaine users that even though they're not using an opioid, they should have naloxone on hand in case their cocaine is contaminated. So, we're able to spot all sorts of different types of trends about who's overdosing and other things that we can use to address the crisis.
So the data really provides a more clear picture of the details of the opioid crisis.
Right. It provides us a daily alert for if there's sudden spikes, and it provides us a longer-term view as to who some of the people are who are overdosing, where they're overdosing, what the things are that they're overdosing on.
Since you started collecting the data a couple of years ago, has the volume of data increased? And I would assume if that's the case, it gives you even more information or the health system at large more information to go on when determining exactly what's going on and what to do.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, we found that the overdoses have been increasing. A couple years ago, we thought we might have reached a plateau, but instead it looks like they've shot back up. And our SWORD data also has been backed up by the state medical examiner's data, which looks specifically at fatal overdoses. And they showed 2020 was the highest year yet for Connecticut.
So there's a correlation here between the increase in overdoses and the pandemic?
Yes, definitely. Starting in April, we saw a sudden uprise. And I think what's happened with the COVID is that COVID has driven people even further into isolation, and isolation kills. People die of opioid overdoses largely for two reasons. One is they use alone. So if they overdose, there's no one there to spot them to give them naloxone. And if you don't get naloxone in time, you're not going to be revived if you stop breathing. The second reason that people die is because of a contaminated drug supply. Years ago, if people bought heroin on the street, it was pretty much, you know, heroin with a little bit of cut in it. Typically, a bag of heroin might be 50% heroin and 50% a cut. With the advent of fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin, the dealers have only have used a smaller amount of active ingredient. So rather than getting 50% active ingredient, there's maybe 1, 2, or 3, or 4% active ingredient. And the problem with that is it makes it very hard to get an equal mix. So if you're mixing 50-50, it's pretty good. But if you're putting, you know, 1 or 2% of an active ingredient in a bit of cut, somebody might get a bag that doesn't have any in it, and someone else might get 10% of the fentanyl, and that could be a lethal dose. So now people just don't know. There's no quality control to know what they're getting. So that unreliable supply combined with people using in isolation is what causes the increase in the deaths.
Can this information that you're gleaning from this data, can it be put to practical use to coming up with solutions to mitigating isolation or dealing with this influx of fentanyl and mixed drugs that people are overdosing on?
Right, yes. The information, we share it regularly with the local health departments, the state health department, and some of the federal, it's called the New England High Intensity Drug Task Force. And they look at all this stuff, and we're able to spot that there's problems with the counterfeit pills, with cocaine contamination, and with various other things. And so we're able to get some public information out there and help address this crisis.
Your new book, called A Killing Season of Paramedics Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Opioid Epidemic, which I understand is due out this month, April 2021. Could you share with us a couple of experiences over the past year as you've responded to calls involving opioid overdoses?
Yeah, well, let me just give you a brief background on my history of being a paramedic and dealing with opioid overdoses. I started 25 years ago, and I thought when I responded to opioid overdoses that the people who had overdosed had character flaws. I felt that this was a willful thing that they were doing, and all they needed to do was just say no. I'd say to them, you know, stop what you're doing. You're going to end up dead or in jail. Probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I noticed the number of opioid overdoses I was doing just started dramatically increasing. And what I started doing then is I'd ask my patients why they started using. And only when I started listening to their stories did I start to understand that I had been wrong, that opioid use was not a character flaw, but actually it was addiction, a chronic relapsing brain disease. Because all these people would tell me their stories. You know, they'd say, I was a normal person once, and then I broke my back in a car accident. I got prescribed medication from a doctor. As my tolerance grew, he gave me, you know, higher doses, and then he cut me off. I was horribly sick. I had to buy pills on the street. They were expensive, and the same person selling me those pills could sell me heroin, which was basically the same stuff, much cheaper. All of these people, I'd ask them one after the other. I hurt myself in sports. I hurt myself on the job. I fell off a roof. I had a tumor. All these people were normal. And then suddenly something tragic happened to them, and then they got caught in this terrible spiral. So I began, you know, as I heard their stories, they taught me stuff that I hadn't learned. And I think the problem is we stigmatize people who use drugs, and we don't really realize the circumstances of what's happened to them and how drugs have affected them. Rewired their brain in many cases, so it's a very, very difficult disease to escape from. So I'll just tell you a very interesting story that I had. I got called for a overdose outside of an old hospital that's now a rehab center, not a normal hospital. We arrived and we found a person was unresponsive, not breathing, gave him naloxone, and he came around. And he looked at me and said, what a scumbag I am to think that I almost died this way. And as you know, I took him to the hospital, and I'm talking to him. And as I'm assessing him, I noticed he had a scar on his chest. What was that from? Oh, he got shot in Iraq. It turns out he was in a, been ambushed. His Humvee had blown up. He'd been shot. Only a few people who made it back from his group. This was a guy who volunteered to join the service the day after 9/11. He left the Army with a Purple Heart and with a horrible addiction to pain medicine that was given prescribed to him from his doctors. When he came back out, you know, his life was very difficult trying to deal with things. He ended up going to jail for an outstanding warrant for having a broken taillight. And because he missed his court appearance, he was in jail. So when he got out of jail, he got picked up by some of his buddies who gave him a bag of heroin to celebrate. He snorted it. He hadn't done it for a while, so his tolerance was down, and he stopped breathing, so they threw him out of his car. You know, and this guy's looking at me going, what a scumbag I am. And it's like, you know, sir, you went and fought for your country. We have a saying here, we leave no one behind. And that should apply not just to our servicemen, but to all of our people who have fallen victim to addiction. Fortunately, we took him to the hospital, and I told his story to some of the staff members, and there was a procession into his room of people thanking him for his service. And it just brings to the point that these people out here, they're our brothers, they're our sisters, mothers, fathers, cousins, neighbors, members of our community. And rather than casting them out and driving them into the shadows, we have to recognize that they have a medical disease and do everything we can to help them.
It certainly sounds like what you've experienced responding to opioid overdose calls on the street has changed your general thinking about how people wind up in the situations that they're in when you come upon them.
Yes, it's absolutely. You begin to understand that the person that you're treating is not just a disease or a criminal or a person that has no attachment to the world. This could be you. This could be a member of your family. This could be a member of your community. And we are all just only, you know, an accident away from being on the other side of the stretcher. You know, it could, you know, so it's like we really have to treat everybody with kindness.
I have one other question regarding the data. The data that's been collected so far, is that up through the end of last year, or do we have data for early 2021?
Data up to this morning.
Oh wow!
I mean, it's constantly coming in, and I can tell you we've had over 8,000. We've had over 8,000 calls so far that have been recorded.
And that's statewide in Connecticut.
Statewide, yeah.
And the data that you've seen and the information gleaned from the data, is that indicating that this upward trend in terms of overdoses is continuing, or have you seen a plateau? What is it telling us for at least the beginning of 2021?
It's continued. 2021 compared to 2020 is higher every month so far. So it has not relented.
Mr. Canning, thank you so much for your time today and your information about SWORD, the collection of opioid overdose data. We really appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure. And thanks for having me on.
Peter Canning is the lead EMS coordinator at UConn Health John Dempsey Hospital and also works full-time as a paramedic in Hartford. His new book, due out this month, is called Killing Season, A Paramedic's Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Opioid Epidemic. With the number of opiate-related overdoses on the rise in Connecticut, lawmakers and health officials are developing programs and strategies to help save lives. Dr. David Feline is among them. He's professor of medicine, of emergency medicine, and of public health, and director of the Yale Program in Addiction Medicine. Dr. Feline joins me now on the phone. Doctor, welcome back to The Full Story.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Back in December, you were part of a crisis summit to address what's been described as the skyrocketing opioid crisis. And at that time, the state's Connecticut's opioid overdoses were projected to result in a record number of deaths in 2020. And I'm wondering, did that turn out to be true?
Yes, Connecticut, along with almost all the states in the United States, have experienced a dramatic increase in opioid and other drug-related overdose deaths, which, of course, is just the tip of the iceberg. But in Connecticut, we've seen a 17% increase in opioid-related overdose deaths, much of this driven by both the pandemic and the increasing use and availability of illicit fentanyl, which is a very high-potency opioid.
And I would like to get into those topics in just a moment. But first, can you tell by what's happened in this first quarter of 2021 what this year is going to look like in terms of overdoses and unfortunately related deaths?
So unfortunately, we've seen pretty much a steady rise since 2013 in the state in opioid overdose deaths. In the past 3 to 4 years, we continue to have over 1,000 individuals whose lives are lost due to the opioid and other overdoses in the state. And it looks like this year will continue in that trend. And many of the forces were existent prior to the pandemic. I always refer to this as our pre-existing condition. And then there have been additional forces related to changes in drug supply, increased isolation, dramatic changes in the way treatment is delivered, and even access to treatment. And we know this is all in the setting of a patient population that's much more vulnerable to things like pandemics.
And could you talk a bit more about the effect of the pandemic on the crisis? What's the relationship there?
So as I mentioned earlier, you know, oftentimes substance use can be a coping strategy for individuals in the setting of increased stress. Many individuals have increased responsibilities at home, job losses, economic stress, and so all of those things will lead to increased substance use. And then we have that in the setting of what's really a toxic or a poisoned drug supply. And if you have individuals who are not able to access treatment or access to treatment is limited or the modalities of treatment have changed drastically, that is a recipe for, unfortunately, the scenario that we're seeing now, which is increased mortality related to opioids in the state.
Is this a situation of demand and supply to some extent, the effect of the pandemic on the emotions and the way people have been feeling during this long period of isolation for many? Did that lead to the availability of these cheaper and more toxic drugs, or was that supply there already and coronavirus pandemic simply led to a heavier demand on it?
Yeah, unfortunately, I see this as a trend that you know, has been going on since the probably the early 2000s, and an ongoing rise of opioid use disorder. Much of it initially fueled, well, back in the 70s by heroin and then subsequently by prescription opioids that were diverted to illicit markets. And it was around 2013 that we saw the uptick in the availability and now pretty much a complete saturation of the market with illicit high-potency fentanyl to the extent that it's now extending into what sometimes are considered non-opioid drug supplies. So cocaine, ecstasy, and other things are now poisoned with these high-potency analogs. And, no, this trend has been on the rise for quite some time, and we've been working with the state and with others to try to make sure that we expand access to naloxone, that we expand access to the most effective treatment strategies, which are medication-based, medications like buprenorphine and methadone. That we focus on those individuals who are at highest risk, which are folks who have experienced a non-fatal opioid overdose, and that we try to maximize the use of data. I think one thing we've learned from the COVID pandemic is how we can take real-time data and put it to use to help address an epidemic or a pandemic. And we need to be much more strategic and much more nimble on our feet when we're in our use of data and linking data sets to help address the opioid crisis.
Is the use of data, is the access to data, the compiling of data, is that getting more efficient, more usable as this crisis, both, well, the two crises, I guess, the pandemic and the uptick in opioid use continue?
I think there's been a recognition of the value of data as a result of the COVID pandemic, and I think the state has made great strides in trying to make data more readily available. I think the biggest challenge is linking data sets, and so if you use the scenario of smoking and lung cancer, if you have the information about smoking risk in one data set and lung cancer in a different data set, you would never be able to determine the association between those two conditions. And currently, the data sets in Connecticut are, I would liken to that scenario. We need to be able to link these data sets in such a way that we can see meaningful associations and act upon those associations in near real time. So if we're tracking the proportion of individuals who have experienced a non-fatal overdose, we need to be able to determine what percentage of those individuals get into the most effective treatments, which are the medication-based treatments, within 7 days or 30 days. Without measuring it, we're not able to improve metrics such as that.
Governor Lamont just recently announced the expansion of a program that would integrate some electronic health records of patients with the prescription drug monitoring program. Is this the type of data that you're talking about?
So I think that's an important step forward. We worked on a program, a strategic plan under Governor Malloy in 2016, and did something very similar with the three large hospital and healthcare systems in the state, where we essentially embedded the prescription drug monitoring program in the electronic medical record that the physicians and the clinicians are already using. The prior system, and there are probably some still in the state who need to do this, you need to log out of one system, go into a second system, come back to your earlier system, and then you can consider safe prescribing. By embedding this prescription drug monitoring program on the screen that the clinicians are using in real time, we felt confident that we were assisting the physicians in making more informed decisions. So I think that's the type of user interface and data management that can be effective, but there's so many other opportunities that we haven't yet completely taken advantage of.
We're talking with Dr. David Feline, the director of the Yale Program in Addiction Medicine. Doctor, you had mentioned before that there are inequities in treatment access and also some problems with the delivery of treatment. Could you expand on that a bit more and how that relates to the opioid crisis that we're experiencing right now?
So the treatment system has evolved, especially the treatment system for opioid use disorder has evolved fairly dramatically since 2000 with the advent of a medication like buprenorphine that can be prescribed by a clinician in an outpatient such as a primary care office and filled by a patient in a pharmacy, a local retail pharmacy. That's really been a major paradigm shift. And luckily, institutions like Yale and colleagues in Connecticut have been at the forefront in making that type of medication and treatment much more readily available. And we often combine this with counseling as the patients need. despite that, there are large inequities in who has access to treatment, which populations, which demographics, which races. And so the treatment programs in the state are trying to do their best in making sure that they can get open, stay open, provide face-to-face visits, and also address many of the structural inequities and structural vulnerabilities of the patient populations. But all of this takes resources, and as you might imagine, funding is short, and healthcare systems are experiencing losses. Large academic medical centers are experiencing losses. Hospitals are experiencing losses as a result of COVID. And so resources are not necessarily getting to the high-need population, such as individuals with substance use disorders.
Are we taking more steps back than forward then at this point as we attempt to treat people with addiction disorders in the middle of a pandemic?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I think the road forward has been clear for a while. I think we're making gradual progress. I think we need to recognize that despite that gradual progress, that the numbers remain unacceptably high. And so we need to think through alternative strategies. We need to double down on the strategies that we're currently using with respect to implementation. And we need all of this to be guided by metrics and real-time data sources that help us really do what we need to do to help the citizens of the state.
Something you said at the crisis summit, treatment is stigmatized. Why is that?
I think that relates to the long-term misunderstanding of the biologic and the neurobiologic basis of addiction. I think most of us were raised with the perception that some aspect of mental health in general and substance use specifically related to poor will or poor behavior and poor choices. We now recognize that a minority, but a sizable minority of individuals who are exposed to substances will become dependent on those substances and experience an addiction, and that those addictive changes are the result of neurobiology and biologic changes at the cellular and even the proteins that individual cells make. Having said that, most of the effective treatments that we have involve both medications and counseling strategies. And until we allow for individuals to receive these treatments and not experience stigma, they will be reluctant to mention that they have these conditions, reluctant to go to specialty centers. And that's part of the reason we've tried to take advantage of relationships that they already have with their primary care physicians, with their OBGYNs, when they're in the emergency department. We need to create as many opportunities and touch points in the healthcare system for individuals to feel comfortable, to encounter a knowledgeable workforce, and create what we've coined sort of the no-wrong door. Any place you present to the system will be able to effectively make an accurate assessment and put together a care plan. We do that for all other medical conditions, and it's now time, given the prevalence, given the devastation that we're seeing in this condition, that we do that for patients who have addictive disorders.
You've also pointed out at the summit and earlier in our discussion, you pointed out that this is kind of just the tip of the iceberg. And part of that is in this sense, entire families are affected by opioid use disorder. What kind of support do families need if someone that they love is struggling with addiction?
That's just such a wonderful question. And I think we, unfortunately, we are focusing way too much on the, and importantly, on the mortality numbers. But we need to recognize that that is just, as you said, the tip of the iceberg. For every person who has died or who experiences a non-fatal overdose, there are probably hundreds of individuals and their family members and their children and their spouses and their partners who are being affected by this. And so, first of all, we need education. We need education so that individuals understand that sometimes these behaviors are beyond the control. That's sort of the characteristic diagnosis of somebody who has an addiction, is that they're not in control of these actions as they relate to their use of substances. We need to provide access to education, to social support services. We need to support folks who are doing well in their addiction, in their ability to parent, to work, to avoid criminal persecution for their substance use, if that's all they're experiencing. I think we need to develop a system that recognizes and supports both families who are working and have somebody in their family with an addiction, but also individuals with substance use disorders, and quite frankly, minimize or decrease the stigma so that folks feel comfortable.
Given the isolation that's needed during the pandemic, I would imagine getting that kind of support, family support, is pretty difficult.
I think that's an important point. We've seen drastic changes in the way support services are provided in the midst of the pandemic. A lot of services have moved to what's called telehealth, but what often is just telephone-based care. And that's new to everybody. That's new to the providers. That's new to the patients. And we've now developed some experience with that. But we need to make sure that that we're checking in with individuals that we're interacting with and make sure that these services are adequate. Now that vaccination is available, we need to make sure that folks have access to vaccination and also that they have access to other healthcare services that they might need.
I think something else you also said during the crisis summit, you said we need our Magic Johnson.
So, and I think that's a very important reference. I think we can all think back, or many of us can think back to the 90s and the extent to which HIV was stigmatized. And here we had somebody who had HIV, who was receiving medication and was doing incredibly well, was continuing to play basketball, for instance, and it was a public figure. I think most people are not able to think or imagine a celebrity or a public figure who has opioid use disorder and says, I'm taking my medication and I'm doing incredibly well. And so we need more examples of that. Unfortunately, we tend to focus too often on those individuals when they're not doing well. And we focus on the relapse, but not those who are doing well, who are on medication, and can be a positive role model. I have many of my patients who exist in society, perform functions, and are building houses, building our bridges, taking care of our family members, and doing so in the setting of COVID that are completely invisible to the rest of the world. And we just don't have an accurate picture of who our colleagues and friends are with opioid use disorder who are doing well on medications like methadone or buprenorphine.
Many people have become addicted to opioids because they were prescribed pain medication at some point, and then that progressed into addiction and abuse of either those prescriptions or something involving fentanyl and the illicit drugs. And I'm wondering, are doctors trained to help patients wean themselves off these medications so they can avoid addiction, or are they trained in knowing the process that can end the use effectively of the opioids when they're no longer really needed?
Unfortunately, I have to say the answer is no. And I point primarily to the fact that there's still limited science on the safe strategies of using these medications, what the duration of time is, when you need to start the taper, and it probably varies from individual to individual. So not all patients are the same. We do know that there are certain risk factors that put folks at increased risk for developing an opioid use disorder if they're exposed to opioids. And for too long, especially in the 90s and 2000s, we were prescribing these very highly potent psychoactive medications and did not have what you're describing, which is an appropriate exit strategy. And I think we're making progress. We're doing some of the science. We're working to incorporate this into curriculum. But all of this, takes time and takes resources and really takes a knowledgeable training and education workforce. And so we need to invest in this in medical school, in nursing school, in dentistry school, in physical therapy school, in PA school, all of the various disciplines that interact with patients so that it's not just a specialty and that it really provides training to the broad band of the workforce that interacts with individuals.
You mentioned earlier that addiction to other substances has grown as well in recent years, certainly during the pandemic. And I'm wondering, do any of these strategies that are being developed and researched for use against the opioid crisis useful in battling other addictions, whether it be cocaine or even alcohol, other addictive substances?
That's such a great question. I think we tend to think about addiction as a monolithic diagnosis, but it's very important to understand exactly what the substance is in order to help somebody come up with an appropriate treatment plan. It's as if we thought about all cardiac disease or all cancers as the same. And if you think about addiction, just as you pointed out, the various substances have very unique profiles. They have very unique withdrawal syndromes. And they do respond preferentially to different types of medications or different types of medications in combination with counseling strategies. The best examples that you just listed, tobacco, alcohol, opioids, we do have effective medications for the most part for many of those conditions. And we have effective counseling strategies that can be paired with those medications. Unfortunately, for stimulant disorders and things like methamphetamine and cocaine, we're less resourced with respect to medications, although there is some recent research indicating in the New England Journal that there might be a hopeful combination of medications. So we tend to rely more in stimulant and marijuana use with behavioral counseling strategies. And those are very prescriptive, the ones that we know work and the ones that may not work as well. And so I really encourage folks, if they're looking for treatment for themselves or for a family member, to go to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, to look for their evidence-based treatments, and to seek out programs to provide those evidence-based treatments. I think that's another very important area. The opioid epidemic and the opioid crisis has really highlighted the extent to which there's large variability in the quality of treatment that programs provide. And groups like Shatterproof and other organizations are working on developing quality metrics so that you can rest assured that if you're going to a treatment program or if you're taking a family member to a treatment program, that they are abiding by the standards and the qualities, because this is a condition that really can put families and other individuals at the mercy of not always the most scrupulous players in town.
Dr. Faleen, what would you say is the biggest barrier that people face when they seek to get access to treatment?
So I think the biggest barrier is probably understanding the neurobiologic basis of addiction, the fact that we have effective treatments, and that treatment is long-term. Oftentimes, these are chronic and relapsing conditions for many individuals. And oftentimes, families and patients are looking for a surgical fix or a quick fix to what is a chronic condition. And so understanding the biologic nature of the disease, leaving behind the stigma that they may have around the type of treatments that's provided, and being able to access the highest quality evidence-based care. I think all of those in combination are important barriers that we need to address.
Dr. Feline, thanks so much for sharing this information and your time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate your interest in this area.
Dr. David Feline is the director of the Yale Program in Addiction Medicine. Back in November of 2019, we spoke with Dr. Craig Allen about the challenges of making recovery services available to those struggling with addiction. Well, 4 months later, COVID-19 changed just about everything. Dr. Allen is the Vice President of Addiction Services with Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network. He's also the Medical Director of the Rushford Treatment Center in Middletown. And we've asked Dr. Allen back to follow up on how the pandemic changed the way people find access to treatment and if there are enough resources, enough services to meet the need. And Dr. Allen joins us now via Skype. Doctor, welcome back to The Full Story.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on. It seems like it's been about 5 years.
Yes, definitely. I know what you mean. And when we spoke to you in late 2019, about 5 years ago, you know, there was already a heavy demand for services related to opioid use disorder. Then during the pandemic, overdoses and deaths have been reported to have gone up. How has that affected demand for treatment? Has there been a corresponding demand for treatment as those overdoses and deaths have risen?
Yeah, so the irony is this. The number of deaths from opioid overdose has gone up. And COVID, amongst other things, has been a direct contributor to that. But COVID has also impacted, I believe, the numbers of people and the willingness to seek treatment. And people being afraid of the infection, understandably, people not sure how to access treatment when suddenly not available in the traditional ways. And some treatment programs closed down. So our biggest challenge when all this happened, and you know, I think of it, it happened in March. It was this. I was totally focused on addressing the crisis, which had started to get worse because of very powerful synthetic opioids like fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. It had started to get worse before COVID hit. And, you know, we, Hartford Healthcare, had a visit from the then Surgeon General Jerome Adams, and it was planned in very early March. And I was on the stage talking about our programs and what we were doing, and my boss and boss's boss and the senators and dignitaries were in the audience, and I was really, really focused on identifying the challenges. And the Surgeon General was very gracious and knowledgeable, and I didn't notice all of the elbow bumping going on and people talking and whispering about this virus. And it was at that time, you know, after I was on stage with the Surgeon General, I shook his hand afterwards, and I tell the story that I am the last person to shake hands with a sitting Surgeon General. After that, everything was COVID, everything was the virus, and this pandemic overwhelmed what was an ongoing epidemic of opioid overdoses. And in the state of Connecticut, there was an increase in opioid overdose deaths of nearly 15% in 2020. And that was over a number that had been the highest ever in the state in 2019, which was over 1,200 deaths. So it has been a tragic time. And as I started to say, during that period of time, the number of people actually getting into treatment has gone down. And so our efforts were focused on trying to reach people where they were at, transitioning very quickly to virtual appointments, using telehealth, using the telephone, you know, old-time medicine, but also leveraging our recovery support service people who work with our programs, you know, people with lived experience and special training, trying to get out and connect with people. And we were also using a digital application, which we continue to use and we had been using, which we found exploded in its utility and in the use that it served. This tricycle data smartphone application, where our patients would enter their information in, and they would do some journaling. And if they were really struggling, we would get a signal. Our recovery support specialists and clinicians could get a signal and try to reach out to them. And it was an added way to stay connected to people with our groups, having to have 6-foot distancing, and with the fear of the virus, even limiting in-person access completely, we had to use all resources available to us.
Your point about keeping in touch with those looking for or needing treatment, I'm wondering, at the beginning of the pandemic, as you mentioned, the number of people looking for treatment was dropping. How much of the bad outcomes, the overdoses and deaths, do you think can be attributed to simply people backing off from treatment due to the pandemic compared to the amount of the more easily obtainable, higher potency drugs like fentanyl being out there?
You know, hard to differentiate. I think both are contributors. I'll say one thing that I'm very curious about. And we always are looking at the numbers of patients who are in our system and overdose and certainly with overdoses and deaths. And I was looking at the last 6 months, and our numbers are lower than they've been for 6 years. And initially I thought, this connectivity, this use of recovery support specialists, the use of smartphones and telephones and telehealth, and our programs that's actually sent clinicians out in the streets. Here in Meriden, we partner with the city, and we have a program, we call it MORE, and it's for people who've overdosed, and first responders work with them. Have all of these had a significant impact? But what the confounding variable is, well, our volumes have gone down too. And so it would be really important to know whether the rate of overdose deaths has gone down and the connectivity and the efforts that we've been making have helped. We know that the signal was already there before the pandemic, and that was felt to be related to fentanyl. So even back in December of 2019, January 2019, I think February was a blip, a bump up in the state of Connecticut. And so even then we were saying, wow, fentanyl all of the barriers we put up, fentanyl's finding ways around it. And then services were shut down, and then people were supposed to quarantine and became more isolated and disconnected. And the stress of physical health and the stress of family health and the stress of financial problems, all the things that drive substance use occurred. All the things that drive depression and anxiety, which also drives substance use and vice versa, all of those things started happening. So that's a difficult question. I think it's a combination of both, but what we know for sure is the numbers have gone up, and they've gone up significantly.
I'm talking with Dr. Craig Allen, the Vice President of Addiction Services with Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network. I should mention that Hartford Healthcare is a financial supporter of WSHU, but we cover the company, and we cover the information like we would any other organization. As you mentioned, we know the opioid epidemic, the overdose and death epidemic was already underway before the pandemic started. I'm wondering, for people who are in recovery or had been in recovery, did you see more relapse than usual once the pandemic hit? Were more people finding themselves, back into an addiction habit?
Well, I think in some cases it surprised people who were, working a good program. They were attending a community support recovery support programs like AA and NA and Smart Recovery and so forth. They had their sober networks. They were engaged in wellness activities, exercise, extracurricular stuff, involved with the church, singing in the choir, painting with their group and so forth. When that's gone, I think we all noticed that things changed and our attitudes and our well-being and our psychological outlook changed. And I think that, you know, for people who, for some people in recovery who had the associated, the physiological changes that can take place in your brain when you develop an addiction, they may have been surprised that they went back to their brain telling them, here's something that can help. And you know, people use substances, particularly during very stressful times, because, they do help. They make people feel better for a period of time. They make people feel less anxious. They make people feel less alone, but only for a period of time. And if you have a substance use disorder or you're in recovery, so you have a history of one, the likelihood of you progressing to having a problem again is very, very high. One of the things we saw, there were some studies that came out around alcohol, was that initially everyone was buying more alcohol and overall people were using more alcohol. But the people that really got into trouble were those individuals who already used a lot of alcohol, maybe not at the level of being diagnosed with an alcohol use disorder, but they used more, or they binged, they used in a binging fashion. So maybe they were relying on alcohol to help them feel more relaxed or to help them enjoy social situations more than others. Those are the people that seem to really escalate in their use. And, when I would talk with my patients, certainly, but with community groups and so forth via Zoom virtually, I would say, you have to watch out. You have to be vigilant because it can sneak up on you, particularly if your brain has already been leaning towards using substances to address anxiety and low mood to begin with. Those are the people that seem to do the worst. But I had a fair number of folks who came back into treatment who had, I could list a number of stories where they had gotten their life on track and then it all disappeared. So there were no more AA meetings in person. There were no more art groups. The church choirs were not meeting together and singing. People were not going to services. All of these wellness activities were gone. And so people needed to be much more creative and much more, proactive, aggressive, kind of had to start over while, they're being told you need to stay inside. You need to stay away from all of these people. I think we did see a fair number of people surprised by this who were in recovery slide back into using again. And if they got into treatment, then I think, they have a history of being able to get back on track and use the tools that they have and work with the medical professionals to get back into recovery. But certainly much more challenging with a lot of the tools being taken out of the toolbox.
The pandemic layered on top of the opioid crisis, as you mentioned before, forced really the healthcare industry and treatment providers to come up with different ways or new ways of getting a handle or trying to get a handle on the opioid crisis. Do you think there are things that have been learned so far during the pandemic, are systems or ideas that will be here once the pandemic, whenever that might be, has pretty much passed? In other words, has there been an advancement in treatment ideas brought on by the pandemic?
That is a great question. And I'm on a lot of, I'm in a lot of meetings. You're never in anything anymore. You're always on something. You're on this platform, you're on that platform. But I talk with people around the state and through different organizations, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, At the state level, the Alcohol and Drug Policy Council, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and on the national level, National Council of Behavioral Health. And what I hear on the positive side, and there's always something to be learned, are the benefits of this relaxed ability to connect with people virtually. Whether it's with a telephone, I joked, earlier about old time medicine using a telephone, even using a telephone, but using telehealth, whatever platform you're talking about, and looking again at some of the restrictions that end up being barriers or some of the components of treatment that might not be that necessary in order to give someone the care that they need, those fell away because of COVID, and some of those things are not going to be coming back. But I think that, and for a good reason, because they were blocking people from getting care, and I think we were able to see a lot of that. Telehealth shouldn't go away. Telehealth is only going to get bigger. The convenience, I've met with my patients, they stepped outside of church. I meet with them in their garage. I've seen their pets. I've seen the handiwork they've done at home and their cabinetry and so forth. I've met with people who forgot about their appointment and pulled over into a parking lot. I think that's right. I met with one of my patients and she was at the hospital. Her sister had just had a baby. These meetings, these appointments are really important, but it's so much more convenient. So yes, there are aspects of medicine that really should take place face-to-face and in-person, but there are components that don't have to be that way and are much more accessible and maybe even less stressful and more personable to be done in this virtual fashion. So I think that those are some of the things that we have learned, along with the truth that not everyone has access to telehealth, and that isn't the end all be all, and we need to offer multiple different ways to connect with people and stay connected with people. And I think we knew this in healthcare. I think we knew this in behavioral health, but it really reinforced the importance of being connected to the people you are trying to help in a real way, whether you are the direct provider or you're part of a team. Staying connected to someone has a lot to do with their sense of whether you care and their sense of whether they trust what it is you have to offer. And people do better when they feel cared for and when they are connected with and engaged.
A broad question to end the conversation today. What can be done to prevent people from becoming addicted in the first place?
There's always the glib, don't use addictive substances.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there. I don't think that works. 70-80% of high school seniors have used addictive substances. We're not going to give up on everybody who's used an addictive substance, and it's difficult to believe that people are not going to try addictive substances and push. That's the way not to become addicted, of course. There are vulnerabilities. Understanding what some of the vulnerabilities are, understanding who might be at greater risk of developing a problem. So if you have a family history of any kind of substance use disorder, your father, mother, grandfather was an alcoholic, had alcoholism, your risk of developing an addiction to any other substance is higher than someone else's. If you have a psychiatric disorder, your risks are higher. If you are under the age of, 24, but we can say 21, your risks of developing a problem are much higher. If you use any addictive substance, we're talking about cigarettes, here in Connecticut, on the verge of voting on legalization of marijuana, we're certainly talking about marijuana. We're talking about alcohol. If you're using before your brain is fully developed, you're at risk. So one of the ways to try to prevent addiction is, if you can't stop everyone from using until their brains are fully developed, is to educate people on what are the high-risk situations. Understand that if you're going to drink alcohol, there are some guidelines that are felt to be safer and not, and over those guidelines is riskier. And if you know what those guidelines are and you do some self-monitoring, that can be really, really helpful. So being vigilant about the risk. If you find that you're using substances to manage your moods on a regular basis, anxiety on a regular basis, or manage difficult situations, then you're at risk. And taking an inventory and having some introspection is a great idea. There's a very popular dry month. It's gone on in the United States too, but in the UK, it really took hold over the last few years, where people go for a certain month. You know, they all, I think it's during January, February, and they say, well, I'm not going to drink this month. And, whether people are able to do it or not, it allows them to really think about how much they were drinking, in what situations they were, and this isn't just for drinking, but in what situations they were drinking, how often, how much, dangerous situations. And that ability to really take a look, take a step back, take a look can be helpful. If you're using a substance to manage your anxiety, there are a lot of other proven approaches to managing anxiety. If you use substances to be more comfortable in a social situation, there are a lot of other strategies to work on those issues and not to be using substances. So, getting regular exercise, getting your needs met through different social situations or gratifying, volunteering your time, different gratifying clubs and so forth. Are ways to have a more well-rounded life where if you are going to use substances, you can use them in moderation. The problem with opioids and is that with drugs like fentanyl, which now, in the state of Connecticut, you can essentially say if you're using an opioid, so if someone says, oh, I'm using heroin or whatever, I'm taking these pills, it's probably got fentanyl in it. Those pills may be fake pills. 85% of the people that died of opioid overdoses in 2020 had fentanyl on board. It's not heroin anymore. It's all fentanyl. And one experience with a super potent opioid could kill somebody. So there isn't a safe amount of opioids to use. And we started off talking about the opioid overdose crisis. Part of the crisis is that you don't get a pass, and even experienced users of opioids can be and frequently are surprised by, sometimes on the streets they say hot shot. They get a substance that has stuff in it that they weren't prepared for, they didn't know about. The potency is much higher. There's no FDA regulating the street drugs, and the street drugs are getting into all of the drugs. And people are being exposed to opioids through cocaine, to fentanyl, through cocaine, through marijuana, through other drugs or pills that are pressed to look like benzodiazepines or Valium and Klonopin and Xanax. And they actually have the super potent opioid in them, and people can overdose and they can die. And so that argues against the safe use of street drugs. But there may be a way to use legal substances in a much, much safer way with some introspection and taking a step back and looking at why you're using, how frequently and how much.
Dr. Allen, thank you so much for the time you spent with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Dr. Craig Allen is the Vice President of Addiction Services with Hartford Healthcare Behavioral Health Network and the medical director of the Rushford Treatment Center in Middletown, Connecticut. Has the opioid crisis affected you during the pandemic? Please share your story with us. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at FullStoryWSHU. That's our program for today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.